This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to The Economist, offering authoritative insight and opinion on international news, politics, business, finance, science, and technology. Stay tuned for the go-to magazine for great minds around the globe, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is a reading of The Economist, and I'm your reader, Mary Kiefer, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from the July 19th, 2025 issue of The Economist Newspaper Limited. And now I'll begin with the cover story, Winning the War Against Cancer. In 1971, Richard Nixon, then America's president, announced a war on cancer. Just 2 years earlier, the Apollo program had combined big science and big government to put astronauts on the moon. So hopes were high. Some optimistic doctors talked of a cure for cancer within a few years. They were wrong. Today, every adult has had cancer, knows someone who has, or both. Half of men and a third of women in rich countries can expect to suffer from it at some point in their lives. In America, where it is the second most common cause of death, just behind heart disease, it kills around 600,000 people a year. Worldwide, it is responsible for about 1 in 6 of all deaths. If your criterion for success was a cure within a decade, or even 2 or 3 or 4, then you might conclude that the war on cancer has been lost. In fact, things are better than many realize. The progress is plain from the data, and there is every reason to think it will continue. Cancer is related to age. If you strip out longer lifespans, it becomes clear that in the rich world, the early 1990s were an inflection point. Since then, the age-adjusted death rate has been falling, slowly but steadily, year after year. In America, the rate is now about a third lower than in the 1990s. The trend is similar in other developed countries. What some scientists hoped would be a blitzkrieg has turned out to be a steady but successful war of attrition. Some victories have been spectacular. Childhood leukemia used to be virtually a death sentence. Now it has a 5-year survival rate above 90%. Yet because cancer is not one illness, but a whole category, much of the progress has not come from big breakthroughs, but thousands of smaller advances in screening, surgery, and drugs. Future gains will come from 3 main sources. Some will come by applying lessons from the rich world all across the globe. The overlooked success story in the fight against cancer has been prevention, perhaps because cancers that never happen are less visible than those that are cured. For example, smoking rates have plummeted in rich countries. That has probably prevented more than 3 million cancer deaths since 1975 in America alone. Because smoking still causes 1 in 5 cancer deaths around the world, anti-tobacco drives in poor and middle-income countries where smoking remains common stand to do an enormous amount of good. Another source of progress will be cheaper medicines and extra wealth to pay for them. Cervical cancer is one of the most common cancers in women. Almost all cases are the delayed side effect of infection with the human papillomavirus, HPV, a bug. In 2008, Britain began offering a newly developed HPV vaccine to teenage girls. A decade and a half later, rates of cervical cancer among women in their 20s are down by 90%, and British health officials talk of virtually eradicating cervical cancer by 2040. The original HPV vaccine was relatively expensive, but a cheaper version developed in India now underpins a mass vaccination campaign in that country, too. And the last source of progress will be the chemical application of fresh science. This comes in two steps: identifying who is most at risk of developing a cancer, and then finding ways to stop the disease in tracks. As we report this week, both hold promise. Scientists already know of genetic variants that predispose their carriers to certain kinds of cancer, such as a faulty BRCA1 gene that raises the risk of breast or prostate cancer. However, less than half of all cancer patients have a known risk factor. Similarly, only some precancerous cells turn malignant. For example, bowel cancers tend to emerge from polyps, but only 5 to 10% of polyps become cancerous. The aim is to untangle this confusion in order to identify patients very early, when treatment is most effective. That work draws on huge biobanks of tissue samples and on the ability to watch genes switch on and off in living cells, impossible even a decade ago. Armed with new biomarkers in blood or breath and a deeper understanding of how combinations of genes and environmental exposure predispose people to develop cancers, physicians can target those who would benefit from treatment. That is important to prevent people undergoing needless surgery, chemo, and radiation therapy at vast expense and with severe side effects. Having worked out whom to treat, doctors can make use of an expanding arsenal of therapies. Some cheap drugs seem to act as cancer prophylactics. Aspirin, a painkiller, seems to cut the risk of bowel cancer in half when given to those with Lynch syndrome, a genetic disorder that predisposes sufferers to some types of cancer. Metformin, a cheap diabetes drug, cuts the risk of recurrence in women who have been treated for a particular type of breast cancer, GLP-1 receptor agonists such as Ozempic show promise too. Alongside the mainstays of surgery, chemotherapy and radiotherapy, a new technique is emerging that harnesses the power of the immune system. The idea is to boost the body's own ability to attack cancerous cells. Some vaccines, perhaps genetically tailored to individual patients, can target a cancer that is already established. Others, acting more like broad vaccines used against diseases such as the flu, could target precancerous cells. Vaccines of this sort for breast and colon cancer are in clinical trials. Good news often goes unreported, especially if it happens gradually. That is the story of the war on cancer. Not everything is perfect. Treatments are costly. Drug firms worry about being sued for side effects when treating people for diseases they do not yet have, and the Trump administration is planning steep cuts to the National Cancer Institute, setting back the science and putting off a generation of researchers. But costs will fall, treatments will find their way to market, and work goes on in Europe and China, which this year overtook America as the main source of cancer research. That is why the age-adjusted death rate will continue falling year after year. And here is more on that topic. stopping cancer less deadly than you think. It is already a frightening disease, and one that, on the face of things, is becoming ever deadlier. Cancer kills perhaps 10 million people a year, a number that has been rising steadily over the decades. In rich countries, half of men and one in three women develop it at some point. In many countries, including Australia, Britain, Canada, and Japan, people are more likely to die of cancer than of any other cause. Yet these scary numbers are largely a function of demography. As the world's population grows, so does the number of deaths from cancer. The rising median age of people around the world has the same effect. Some cancer can take decades to develop and therefore afflicts the elderly more than the young. Strip out the effects of population growth and aging, and the rate of deaths from cancer has actually fallen markedly over the past 30 years or so. Cancer is becoming much less deadly, and scientists' fast improving understanding of the disease holds out the prospect of further advances for years to come. The declining mortality rate reflects all manner of improvements in prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. The biggest gains have come from reductions in smoking, which causes around 85% of lung cancers and 20% of all cancer deaths. Mammograms, colonoscopies, and cervical smear tests, among other forms of screening, have helped to identify lesions, polyps, and other tissue that may develop into cancer, but that can be removed, preventing any such progression. Better surgical techniques and cancer medicines have improved survival rates for those who do develop the disease. In recent years, immunotherapy, in which the immune system is induced to fight cancer more effectively, has also made big strides. By one estimate, such advances averted nearly 6 million deaths in America between 1975 and 2020 from lung, breast, bowel, prostate, and cervical cancer, which collectively accounted for around 70% of cancer deaths in the late 1970s. Just over half of the averted deaths were the result of reduced smoking. Another 23% stemmed from better screening and 20% from improvements in treatment. Stomach cancer, once common in rich countries, has also declined sharply. In the 1990s, researchers established that it was often caused by Helicobacter pylori. Infections of the bacteria were already declining, owing to improvements in hygiene and greater use of antibiotics since the 1950s, but the discovery spurred testing and direct treatment of them, further reducing the incidence of stomach cancer. Perhaps the most striking breakthrough concerns the prevention of cervical cancer. In the early 20th century, it killed more women in America than any other form of disease. The first headway against it came with the realization that certain changes in the cells in the cervix, visible under a microscope, often progressed to cancer. This led to screening programs to detect and remove suspect tissue before it turned cancerous. Studying the many samples collected in this way led to the discovery that almost all cervical cancers were caused by infection with the human papilloma virus, HPV. The subsequent development of HPV vaccines holds out the prospect of the near eradication of cervical cancer. In Britain, the vaccine has led to a 90% drop in cervical cancer cases for women in their 20s, based on data for the first cohort that was offered the jab at the age of 12 or 13. The success in curbing lung and cervical cancer has become a template for scientists looking for ways to prevent other types of cancer. It has taught them first to identify who is at greatest risk of developing cancer and then to intervene in whatever way works best, getting smokers to quit, getting young women vaccinated against HPV. Most cancers, admittedly, are harder to tackle since their causes are more complex and less well understood. In fact, only around half of all cancer cases can be explained by a known risk factor for the disease. But the wealth of tissue samples collected over the years, along with advances in cellular biology, are slowly making it easier to identify patterns and tailor treatments accordingly. Several new vaccines developed in this way are already in the works. Such data are helping identify prophylactic drugs, too. The hope is that rather than treat cancer once it has developed, many forms of the disease can be stopped from developing to begin with. Cancer does not come out of nowhere, explains Sarah Blagden of Oxford University. It slowly develops over many years, providing ample opportunity for medical intervention. The process starts when genetic mutations cause normal cells to reproduce in ways they should not. As they divide, some of these abnormal cells develop features that help them to hide from the immune cells that normally clear out damaged and diseased cells. The abnormal cells eventually form clumps of tissue called lesions, polyps, or tumors. These lesions can take 5 to 15 years to develop. Once they are big enough, they can be spotted by mammograms, colonoscopies, and the like. Some stop growing or shrink, but others develop into fully fledged cancer, meaning they begin to protrude outside the organ where they first started growing and will eventually metastasize or spread around the body, although that can take a further 5 to 10 years. Most cancer screening programs aim to detect lesions and remove them before they become cancerous, but it is hard to know whom to screen and which lesions, once detected, to remove. Screening tends to be based on very broad criteria, such as age or having a close relative who has had cancer. As a result, many people who are not at high risk undergo unnecessary tests, including invasive procedures that can cause harm. Colonoscopies, for example, can perforate the colon. Biopsies of breast, lung, or other tissues can cause infections and other complications. What is more, only about 25% of the most common type of lesion found in breast tissue turns cancerous. By the same token, although the majority of bowel cancers start from polyps, only 5 to 10% of polyps develop into cancer. Scientists at University College London have discovered that, if left alone, 30% of a particular type of lesion in the lungs regress over time. All such lesions, however, are treated as incipient cancer because there is no way to predict with certainty whether they will turn malignant. The result is lots of unnecessary, expensive, and debilitating surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. One solution to the problem of side effects from testing would be cheaper, less invasive screening methods for lesions, and many are indeed in development, including various breath, blood, or urine tests. Better still would be to find more accurate indicators of who is at risk, to target treatment to those who really need it. Scientists have been making progress in this area too, in two ways: by identifying genetic predispositions and by working out what proteins in blood or tissue might serve as biomarkers of a heightened risk of developing cancer. Some 5 to 10% of cancer cases appear to have genetic origins. About 1 in every 200 people has faults in genes called BRCA1 and 2 that are involved in suppressing cancer. For example, for women, such mutations carry a 60 to 80% risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer. 1 in 300 people has Lynch syndrome, which is caused by mutations in genes involved in DNA repair. These people have a 40 to 80% chance of developing colorectal, endometrial, and other types of cancer. These are extreme cases, but many other genes appear to heighten the risk of developing certain cancers. Since genes are inherited, it is easy to know who to screen for such mutations and then monitor more closely for signs of disease. Another set of clues about who is at risk comes from big medical studies conducted in recent decades to examine links between diet, lifestyle, and cancer. Some of them, such as the EPIC Project, which has tracked 500,000 Europeans for nearly 30 years, have created biobanks of blood samples that allows researchers to examine blood from participants who later developed cancer and to compare it with examples from those who remained healthy to see if there are any distinguishing features. In particular, they have been looking for proteins that are more common among future cancer patients. Such research has found that people with high levels of insulin-like growth factor, a protein that tells cells to grow, are at higher risk of breast and bowel cancer. Biobank samples also helped a team led by Mark Gunter from Imperial College London identify new proteins that seem to be biomarkers of an elevated risk of breast cancer. They've come completely out of the blue in a way, he says. These discoveries are not only useful in themselves, but can also be combined with other data to produce more refined measures of risk. Genetic screening, blood tests, information about diet, exercise, and so on can all be fed into multimodal cancer risk calculators that have entered clinical practice in the past 5 years. Doctors use them to decide, for example, who should have earlier breast cancer screening or take cancer prevention medicines. Rapidly improving technology is helping refine these risk models. It is now possible to test a single blood sample for thousands of proteins rather than the 2 or 3 that would have been the maximum a decade ago. Researchers are investigating whether AI can improve risk prediction by spotting subtle patterns in mammograms or whole body scans. The development of single cell transcriptomics, a technology that analyzes gene expression at the cellular level, has made it possible to see how cells in a tissue sample interact with each other. Previously, the extraction of DNA involved mincing a tissue sample, losing information about individual cells. This and other new analytic methods have yielded detailed information about how immune cells function, for example, or about how proteins indicative of cancer can be detected, the sort of information needed to develop the preventive drugs and vaccines. A research group led by Walid Khaled at Cambridge University has discovered, for instance, that immune cells in the breasts of healthy women who carry BRCA mutations are as ineffective as those found in women with advanced breast cancer. The next step, says Dr. Khaled, would be to identify therapies that can reinvigorate these cells. Vaccines are another field that has progressed tremendously fast in the past decade, says Nora Dysis of the Cancer Vaccine Institute at the University of Washington. We have a much better idea of the type of immune response we need to eradicate the cancer, she says. 5 years ago, says Dr. Dysis, her institute was focusing almost exclusively on vaccines used as a treatment for advanced cancer. Now, she says, about half of the institute's work is on preventative vaccines. Several research groups and biotech firms in America and Europe are testing preventive jabs for breast, colon, and other cancers in patients who are at high risk of the disease, such as those with BRCA gene faults, Lynch syndrome, or precancerous lesions. These jabs are still in early trials. The first results showing whether they reduce the recurrence of polyps or other lesions are expected in 3 to 5 years. In the past, says Olivera Finn of the University of Pittsburgh, there were fears that jabs given to people before cancer had developed might spur the immune system to attack healthy cells. But experience in patients with large stage cancer, for whom the potential life-saving benefits outweighed that risk, showed that such fears were misplaced. The immune system, it turns out, is pretty good at focusing just on the cancer cells. Unlike individualized therapeutic cancer vaccines, which are often tailored to an individual patient's specific cancer mutations, preventive jabs should work for a broad range of patients. In one of the largest clinical studies on how lung tumors evolve, scientists at the University College London discovered that the lung cells of smokers develop specific changes linked to cancer years before the cancer occurs. Researchers at Oxford have developed a vaccine targeting these changes, which is due to start clinical trials next year. A preventive vaccine developed by Nuscom, a Swiss biotech company, uses what its developers call a brute force approach. The jab targets 209 different fragments of molecules found in precancerous and cancerous tissue, but not in healthy tissue. The first round of clinical trials reported in April showed it successfully induces the immune system to target cancer cells, at least in tests in petri dishes. Also in clinical trials is a vaccine for bowel cancer prevention. In 2023, Dr. Finn's group reportedly preliminary results from a vaccine targeting a protein called MUC1, found in 80% of all types of cancers. Although the vaccine prompted an immune response only in a subcategory of people with colon polyps, that group saw a 38% reduction in polyp recurrence within a year. The granularity of data available from big clinical studies is also hastening the identification of drugs that may help prevent particular forms of cancer in specific populations. Researchers have noticed, for example, that people who take aspirin to prevent heart attacks or metformin to treat diabetes have reduced rates of cancer. Clinical trials show that anastrozole, a drug used to treat breast cancer, halves the risk that some postmenopausal women will develop it in the first place, prompting Britain's drug regulator to approve it for prophylactic treatment in 2023. There are now studies investigating whether such drugs can be given in ways that reduce their negative side effects, such as intermittent dosing or applying them topically or via injection only to the tissue of concern. And there is hope that GLP-1 receptor agonists such as Ozempic wonder drugs with all sorts of benefits beyond their original use to manage diabetes might also help prevent certain forms of cancer. Some of these therapies benefit only relatively narrow groups. In 2023, researchers found that metformin can reduce the recurrence of cancer for women treated for one particular form of breast cancer, accounting for about 20% of cases, but not for other types. Such results, showing benefits for specific subgroups of patients, are starting to be seen as the norm in the search for preventive therapies for cancer, says Andrew Chan of Harvard University. It is very unlikely the future will be around something one size fits all. The complexity of cancer, with its bewildering variety of forms, makes devising treatments difficult. Developing vaccines of testing preventative drugs for a disease that can take 15 years to develop is by its very nature a time-consuming task. These obstacles explain why progress against cancer tends to come incrementally rather than through attention-grabbing breakthroughs. The sweeping benefits of broad public health measures, such as reducing smoking or improving food hygiene, have already been reaped, at least in the rich world. Developing future preventative treatments by matching subcategories of patients with a shifting constellation of therapies will inevitably involve a lot of trial and error. But scientists are making steady headway in narrowing down the pool of people at risk and tailoring treatments to them. And because this process is continuous and open-ended, it will go on yielding benefits for decades to come. Cancer has already become a much less deadly disease than it was 30 years ago. 30 years from now, it will almost certainly be less deadly than it is today. This week's obituary is for Simon Groot, the Dutch seedsman who transformed tropical vegetables, died on July 6th at the age of 90. What started him thinking was a cabbage. Not any old cabbage, but the variety, Glory of Enkhuizen, which his family company, Sluis and Groot, had produced in that town in North Holland in 1899. It was a beautiful cabbage, round, compact, with a light green head framed in darker leaves. It could weigh as much as 3 kilograms, had a sweet flavor, and was easy to grow, as it did all over Europe. But not here. Simon Groot was walking in the highlands of Java on a sales trip for the company in 1965, when he came across a field of them. They were a sorry sight, sparse and with misshapen heads. Clearly, the seed was not quite right, messed up or mixed in, adulterated somehow. He hated nothing more than bad seed. But it was also clear that these cabbages, which shrugged off frost, did not enjoy a semi-tropical climate and could not cope with local pests and diseases. Meanwhile, the farmers who had sown them, unable to sell them, remained as poor as ever. For 16 years, he brooded on this. It became his mission. In 1981, when Sluis and Groot was sold to Sandoz, he branched out on his own to improve the seeds, crops, trade, and nutrition of the tropical parts of the world. The staple grains, especially wheat in India and rice in China, had been hybridized already with great success, but lowly vegetables had been ignored. He, by contrast, loved them. Producing fine vegetable and flower seed had been the family business since 1867, when venerable bearded Groots had pioneered the work in Enkhuizen. Seeds had been lucky for the town, too, because of close contacts with local farmers. It did not suffer the famine that followed the war. For him, the vegetables of tropical Asia were a cornucopia of species he had never met before. Amaranth with grain heads like huge catkins, Kang Kong, or water spinach growing in any fresh water, mung beans full of protein in both seeds and sprouts, daikon, tatsoi, choy sum, all were packed with vitamins and good nutrition. As a seedsman more used to cauliflowers and potatoes, he was fascinated. As a market man, here was a huge chance. He surpassed his own expectations. By the 2020s, the seeds produced by his company, East West Seed, had improved the incomes of 20 million small farmers in more than 80 countries, from Asia to Latin America to Africa. The company's red arrow logo was as well known to them as the sign for Coca-Cola. He also set up a program in which successful farmers trained their neighbors. With better seed, farmers stayed in farming. Market traders had more to sell, and consumers had healthier diets. That simple formula lifted everyone. Seeds came first, carefully bred by cross-pollination to produce the right traits. But the farmers were key. He talked to them constantly. A tall and almost colonial figure in his white clothes and sun hat, to learn to think with them. Most of them had plots of only 1 or 2 hectares, so vegetables were an ideal crop. Routinely, though, the glossy packets they started with had bad genetics inside. They then saved the seeds from their crops from year to year because they were poor and it cost nothing. So inevitably, their harvests declined. Yet they were most reluctant to change. When he set up his first base in the Philippines in 1982 and after many months produced his first hybridized seed, farmers were loath to try it. The plant was Ampelia, or bitter gourd, not unlike a far warty cucumber. Astringent but useful to bulk out a stir-fry. So many farmers already grew it. The new variety was called Jade Star. It could resist downy mildew, its chief threat, but almost all the trial crops failed. Hence the importance of any farmer who had succeeded passing on his knowledge of how to handle the seeds, space them, fertilize, and irrigate them. Seed was all about trust. Trust that the tiny speck you sowed would grow into the plant you imagined. Both would take time to appear. Over decades, though, the farmers were won over. When the crops did well, they were extraordinary, healthy, profuse, and vigorous. As more vegetables were hybridized, tomatoes began to flourish in the Indonesian lowlands where they could not grow before. Productivity per plant of bird's eye chili, a Thai favorite, increased by 30 to 40%, and long beans grew like forests. Farm incomes doubled and sometimes even tripled. Certain cases became famous. One woman did so well with Kai Sim, a leaf vegetable, that she built a kitchen and bought a motorbike. Another produced a pile of pumpkins worth $3,500 from $6 worth of seeds. Hybridization meant that seed from the crop could not be kept because the second crop would be unreliable. But he set the price of new seed as low as he could. In 2017, the company sold 24 million value packs, enough for a small plot, for the equivalent of $1 each. Any profits went to growth and research. The farmers seemed to take this system in their stride. When he visited them in later years, they cheered for joy and held parties for him. In 2019, he was awarded the World Food Prize, a nutritional equivalent of the Nobel. His work, however, was far from done. To Asia, he still hoped to shift more in Asia. He still hoped to shift more farmers away from rice. The world had plenty of that. and carbohydrates as well as meat were starting to feature too much in Asian diets. Plants needed constant fortifying to adapt to climate change, and he had barely made a start on Africa, where small farmers were struggling terribly, and the potential for growth was so obvious. In one of his late interviews, he appeared with an array of homegrown vegetables in front of him, his tomatoes and French beans laid out on a dark wood table looked as glossy and beautiful as a still life from the Dutch Golden Age. The vegetable he most often chose to pose with, however, was not the glory of Enkhuizen. It was the watery, bitter, ugly jade star, which had transformed the lives of his farmer friends 6,000 miles away. Should you take creatine? The legal, safe, performance-enhancing drug may have benefits beyond sport. If you are an athlete in search of a chemical boost, your options are limited. Many of the drugs that are known to work, anabolic steroids to make you stronger, say, or erythropoietine to boost your endurance, are banned and come with nasty side effects. Many legal supplements, meanwhile, seem not to do anything useful. An exception is creatine, a staple of sports nutrition and one of the few supplements with a solid evidence base behind it. One review paper from 2017 concluded that creatine can give athletes a 10 to 20% performance boost in brief bouts of high-intensity exercising, such as sprinting past a defender or lifting heavy weights. It appears to be safe, too, with no worrying side effects seen even in people who have been taking the stuff for years. Because there is no test that can distinguish supplementary creatine from the sort naturally produced by the body, or indeed the kind found in meat and fish, most sports do not consider taking it to be doping. Creatine works mainly by increasing the amount of energy that muscles can produce. Cells use a molecule called adenosine triphosphate, ATP, as a carrier of chemical energy. Aerobic respiration, which uses oxygen to break down fats or sugar, is by far the most efficient way of making ATP. But it is relatively slow. When muscles need a lot of ATP in a hurry, most of it is supplied instead by the phosphocreatine system, which, as its name suggests, relies on creatine to work. A third pathway, the glycolic system, sits between the other two in both power and efficiency. When muscles contract, the ATP molecules used to power that contraction lose one of their three phosphate groups, turning into adenosine diphosphate. Phosphocreatine stored in the muscles can donate a replacement phosphate group, turning ADP back into ATP, which can then power more contractions. But those reserves are sufficient for only a few seconds of maximal effort. This is why it is impossible to run a marathon at the same pace as one would run 100 meters. Creatine supplements boost the amount of phosphocreatine that can be stored, allowing users to squeeze out a couple of extra reps or sprint at full speed for a second longer. That may not be the only benefit. A growing body of research suggests creatine may be good for brains as well as brawn. That makes sense. Neurons need ATP just as muscle cells do, and the brain is hungry for energy. Despite accounting for about 2% of the body's mass, the brain is thought to consume around 20% of its calories. As summarized in a review published in 2021 in Nutrients, some studies have suggested that creatine might sharpen things like short-term memory, or reaction times. Others have reported it may lessen the symptoms of mental health problems, such as depression, and tentative evidence suggests it improves cognition in those with Alzheimer's disease. Both may be associated with a misallocation of energy within the brain. In animals, creatine seems to protect against the effects of concussions, which seems to play havoc with the way brain cells are supplied with energy. In one study, rats given creatine supplements showed a 50% reduction in damage after they were given an artificially induced brain injury. For now, the evidence regarding brains is not nearly as robust as that regarding muscles. But as sport is a common cause of concussions, athletes taking creatine might get two benefits for the price of one. From Bartleby, the superstar conundrum. The competition for the world's best AI talent is frenzied. Mark Zuckerberg, the boss of Meta, has personally taken charge of efforts to recruit for a superintelligence lab. The sums on offer are eye-watering, a rumored $200 million plus to prize away the head of Apple's AI models. OpenAI executives are said to be recalibrating compensation in order to ward off Mr. Zuckerberg. But hiring hotshots makes sense only if you believe that talent is portable and that superstars will continue to shine in their new organizations. That is debatable. On average, internal hires outperform external ones. People promoted from within have some obvious immediate advantages over new joiners. They know who to approach to ask dumb questions. They can actually log in. If these kinds of basic procedural issues were the only problem, then a star should quickly brush them aside. But the more profound issue is that a person's performance is not just a matter of their own brilliance. It is often inseparable from the context. The relationships, culture, processes, and tacit knowledge that surround a star. A variety of studies have tried to tease out how much these firm-specific factors matter to the performance of hotshots. Perhaps the best-known research in this area has been done by Boris Groysberg of Harvard Business School. In one paper written with Linda Eiling Lee of MSCI and Ashish Nanda, also of Harvard, Mr. Groysberg looked at the performance of the best investment analysts as measured by external rankings after they had moved firms. In theory, a move ought not to have made much difference to how well they did their job. Analysts often cover the same firms for the same clients. In practice, the star's performance declined compared with colleagues who stayed put. More recent research by Claudia Gabbio-Netta of the University of York and her colleagues found the same thing. They looked at recruitment among British corporate law firms between 2000 and 2017 and found that on average practice areas that hired a star underperformed those that did not in the subsequent year. That may be because incoming stars disrupt the performance of existing employees. A study by Matteo Prato of ESADE and Fabrizio Ferraro of IESE, both in Spain, also looked at the movement of securities analysts to see if the arrival of an ace affected their new colleagues. They found that the performance of the existing team fell, particularly among lower-ranked analysts. That fits with the hypothesis that stars will gobble resources and attention which might have gone to less celebrated peers. There are nuances. In another co-written paper, Mr. Groysberg looked at the performance of top American football players who moved teams, wide receivers whose job entails complicated plans involving words like scrimmage did worse if they switched teams than those who did not. Punters who are very good at kicking a ball but don't have to interact much with their teammates saw no such drop. If a job genuinely depends on individual prowess, talent can travel. Alternatively, a high performance is caused by the interactions of a group of people. Then one answer is to lift out an entire team. Changing employers did not greatly affect the performance of top-tier analysts who moved with their teammates, according to the study by Mr. Groysberg et al. The personality of the new recruits also matters. A study of American biotech firms by Rebecca Kehoe of Cornell University and Daniel Zabar of Drexel University found that collaborative stars helped their peers become more productive. A superstar strategy may make more sense when it comes to AI. This is a field where cutting-edge knowledge is at a premium. Small numbers of talented people can have a disproportionate impact, and there are fewer incumbent employees to disappoint. Equally, the research also suggests that stars do best when they move to a higher-performing firm. What they lose in organizational knowledge and relationships, they make up for with an environment better able to harness their talents. Spraying money on stars in order to play catch-up, in other words, is a gamble that may not pay off. And here's a couple of shorts for this week. The European Union said that it would be virtually impossible for its current volume of trade with America to continue if Donald Trump carried out his threat to impose tariffs of 30% on EU goods on August 1st. The EU is considering tit-for-tat duties on American products, such as aircraft, bourbon, and cars. The president also announced that he would impose a 30% tariff on Mexican imports. A duty of 17% was immediately levied on Mexican tomatoes to protect American farmers. Around 70% of the tomatoes sold in America come from its southern neighbor. Although Mr. Trump's promised trade deals have been few and far between, he did strike with one with Indonesia this week, which lowers its reciprocal tariff rate from 32% to 19%. America's revenue from customs duties hit a new monthly high of $27 billion in June, bringing the total over the second quarter to a record $64 billion. The extra revenue helped the government register a surprise budget surplus in the month. Meanwhile, Chinese exports picked up again in June after America and China agreed to lower tariffs. China's exports to America grew by 32.4% compared with May. The Port of Los Angeles, the main hub for Chinese exports to the U.S., had its busiest ever June. Exporters are rushing to beat a new tariff deadline in August. Boosted by the rush to ship goods abroad, China's GDP was 5.2% bigger in the second quarter compared with the same 3 months last year, a slightly better rate growth than economists expected. The figure marks a sluggish domestic economy. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary Kiefer with a reading of The Economist. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.